Beyond Governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
Did you know that most statistics for commercial and social research are tested for accuracy at a 95% confidence level? As specialists in the field, we do tests between 90 and 99% confidence levels. This is not to be confused with our name. Plus 94 is a celebration of the miracle post 94 in South Africa. We can still test the accuracy of your data at 94%. It is in our name to give you the confidence you need. Plus 94 Research. The science of decision making.
A very good morning to you, the beloved listeners of Beyond Governance show here at, and welcome to this week's installment of the show. If you've been breathless with us with anticipation, well, worry no further, I'm here. As you know, I'm always delighted to share the space and time with you, as my guests are quite knowledgeable and experienced in their field. So we certainly give you the kind of exposure to enhance what you already know or give you a different perspective of some of the complex issues confronting both public and private sector organizations from management and governance perspective. In setting the scene, it has been, obviously the context of our conversations around the quagmire we're facing ourselves, what we're seeing in the state-owned enterprise landscape. So in setting the scene, you know, it has been established that SOEs, state-owned enterprises, have a huge drag on the South African economy growth and public finances. I mean, we must have noted every Auditor General report speaks about maladministration, corruption, interference, lack of internal control, and so on and so forth. I mean, the vast majority of SOEs are technically bankrupt, which means they're struggling to even guarantee financial resources for operation, let alone for investments, repairs. So it's a big issue. We have seen how entities such as Denel, SAA, SABC, Transnet, and our beloved Eskom, going to Treasury year in, year out, for bailouts, and which runs into billions of rands of annually. Having said that, there is no doubt in my mind and pretty much every South African that the SOE plays a strategic importance role. I mean, you can imagine if you don't have SOEs that are well managed in transportation, in communication, we are pretty much in a dark, given the strategic importance they play, and not only from employment creation point of view, but issues of security, of the country. Economic growth hinges largely on SOEs. We all know how other countries, such as South Korea, Hong Kong, and so on and so forth, are literally building the economic growth at the back of well-managed state-owned entities. So in today's conversation, we're simply putting a spotlight on some of the gremlins that are crippling invaluable state-owned enterprises, which I've already alluded to the fact that they play a significant role, and yet the overall performance is simply dismal. Well, in making sense of this leadership and management mayhem, we are seeing in too many of our SOEs, I'm joined by Kaya Sitole, who is an accountant, an academic, an activist, independent, and analyst. Without any waste of time, let me take this opportunity to welcome Kaya. My brother, good morning, and thanks for your time.
Thank you, and good morning to the listeners.
Absolutely. Kaya, I've already painted a picture in terms of where we are at. When you look at the SOE landscape in the country, what is your overall, what is your view in relation to the overall mischief in management and governance of SOEs in this country?
So I think what we have to firstly reflect on is the reason why such entities exist in the first place. And the primary reason, of course, is that governments always have to figure out how to intervene in instances where private capital and private markets on their own would probably not achieve the type of optimum outcomes that society desires. So if you look at some of the big state-owned enterprises in either the utilities industry, for example, it's kind of quite clear that if you were here to 100 years ago, when Eskom was created in 1921, for example, and you wanted to be able to say to private industry or private enterprise that, look, somebody must electrify the country, what's tend to happen with private capital is that the pursuit of profit and the pursuit of shareholder value are obviously the primary interests, which simply means that if you then want to roll out the type of infrastructure that takes this long to pay off, you're unlikely to be able to do that using private resources. So what governments do uniquely and what governments are able to do differently is that they are obviously able to tap into what we call the most patient capital available out there, and that's of course taxpayer resources. And that simply means is that a government can decide that, look, in order for this particular item or this particular industry to be given life, the type of returns that would make it not only possible to roll it out but also affordable to the end user is the type of investment model that says let us look at 20 or 30 or 40 years rather than the 5, 6 or 7 years that a private provider will be looking for. And obviously the ultimate difference there is that if somebody is trying to recover what they've invested within a shorter time frame, it simply means that the cost of delivery must be much higher in order to make sure that they're able to get their return in the shortest time possible. So what governments can then do is to say, well, actually, if we have to apply that model, it would simply mean that the ultimate intention, which is electrification in this example, would simply not happen because nobody would be able to afford those particular tariffs. So therefore, if we step in as a government and then we say we're looking at getting this thing to break even over a much longer time frame, it means that we can smooth the transition in the sense that the access and affordability will be much better under a state intervention compared to private enterprise on its own. So that's really one of the reasons why these entities tend to emerge. So then naturally what you'll see is that in some of the big network industries, like, you know, the telecoms, for example, and other utilities, you'll see that there's a much stronger presence, a much stronger historical presence or involvement of the state in either creating the initial infrastructure for those particular resources, and also, as we now know in the case of South Africa, the continued ownership or involvement in the ownership and governance of those particular models. So that's really where the basis for having state-owned enterprises comes from. So what then happens over time is then there's a simple question of, well, has the state done enough to essentially give birth to an industry that can thrive on its own? In other words, having put out all the baseline infrastructure across the land of the country, are we now able to say, well, private enterprise, we've cut down some of the more expensive fees that are necessary in order to get this done. We've lent the school fees on your behalf. So therefore, you can tap in and participate in this market and participate in this industry and then harness the efficiencies that you kind of famous for in order to make it a more accessible and a more widely available product to the market at large. And that's really how the conversation should be evolving over time. And what we do know is that in South Africa, we got that right in relation to the telecoms industry. So, of course, the state was primarily involved in the creation of Telkom. Telkom basically then builds the infrastructure across the country. And, of course, back in the day, landline infrastructure was the way in which these things were to be done. And then only later on does the state then come back and say, we think the market is now ripe enough for alternatives to emerge and to piggyback on the back of what we as a state have done through Telkom. So this is the emergence and the birth of Vodacom and the birth of MTN. And you can see that that market has evolved much faster than the electricity market, for example. So there are particular upsides onto getting the state to be the grandfather of an industry, provided, of course, that when market forces and when market dynamics allow, then you can be able to open it up in a manner that says ultimately the delivery price or the point of transaction must be lower to the end user than otherwise it would be. And this is another interesting dimension, Nimrod, in that in the instance where no one can answer that decisively. In other words, we cannot say that, yes, the simple involvement of other players is going to reduce the end price. Then you see the role of regulators becoming far more important. So if you think, for example, where South Africa would be in the absence of the National Energy Regulator, which simply means that Eskom would unilaterally decide what the tariff hike should be at any point in time, and nobody would be able to interrogate that because, well, why do you bother if there's not going to be an alternative provider anyway? So then regulators are the ones that come in and basically make sure that even in an entity where we've got these particular dynamics, where it is imperfect competition, as you may call it, then there is a regulatory regime that at least champions or should champion the interests of the end user, even if there's one really dominant supplier in the market, like we've seen in the Eskom case study. So those are just some of the background issues relating to state-owned enterprises. And of course, what then needs to happen is that one needs to make sure that they're governed as well and as transparently as they need to be in order to be businesses. And that's where some of the struggles.
If I can intervene there, you've made a number of very pertinent and interesting points worthy of us probing a little bit further. Before we do that, let's take a quick break. We'll be back in a second.
Beyond Governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
When a nation comes together on buildrsa.co.za, it can only lead to a greater South Africa. All that's missing is you. Go to buildrsa.co.za to join the conversation, get involved in problem solving, and contribute to taking our nation to the next level. By South Africans, for South Africans. So, register for free now at buildrsa.co.za. The Great Africa. Together, we will build it.
Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. My name is Nimrod Mbele. I am joined by Kasi Tolle, who is an accountant, academic, activist, and independent analyst. We're getting our heads around the mayhem we're seeing in the state-owned enterprises. Do weigh in via our social. Our SMS line is 34519. The telegram is 061-895-1019. And of course, your views and thoughts are most welcome via my X handle, which is at Dr. Mbele. Kaya, you know, before we took that break, you really gave us food for thought in terms of we need to understand that the reason for most of this SOE's existence. And in your unpacking, you obviously give a perspective in that the state needs to invest in an environment which ordinarily private sector companies would not, given the massive amount of resources that are required. In a nutshell, the state has to birth a series of industries by putting forward investments that private sector organization can take advantage of moving forward. And also raise a very interesting point about given the imperfect market, I mean, state-owned entities are by their nature monopolistic. And for that to balance off that monopoly, we do have a very strong role of regulators, which are meant to drive or intervene in instances where SOEs are milking more than what is required from the public. So those are very good points that you've shared with us. And I do like the point around how some success stories, if you like, the birth of the telecoms giants such as MTN and Telkom, obviously are at the back of how the state has been able to, over time, plant the seed by way of investments, protect that particular field, and allow the public-private sector organization to build sustainable entities, which should have been or ought to be the rule of the thumb, but that's not real. The telecom success story or telecommunications success stories it should be a norm, but it's an exception.
I think quite interestingly, we have to go back and look at how the ANC, having been in power since 1994, has continuously engaged and deliberated on the question. So one of the interesting ironies is that obviously we now know that a lot of senior ANC leaders, or rather the most influential leaders within the ANC, are people who spend the bulk of their time either being trained or being housed in Eastern European or communist aligned regimes in many respects. And what that seems to have done is that it seems to have infused in them this idea of running an economy the way communist governments tend to run the economy. And the term that they frequently use is this one of the commanding heights of the economy. So what we saw is that at the end of apartheid, then there was a very difficult question that this ANC had to engage with on how to actually manage economic resources. And in the management of economic resources, one also has to reflect on the fact that one of the great ironies of the apartheid regime is that because it was a regime that was committed to self-isolation and isolating itself from the rest of the globe in many, many ways, it meant that it had to create a greater sense of autonomy in the sense that a lot of things you had to do it on your own because you're not going to get access to international capital and international services and providers. So if you look at the story of how an institution like Sasol, for example, is created, well, in the absence of that, you're probably not going to survive running an economy in the light of the embargoes that have been imposed over time in South Africa. So that's just one example of what you saw. So at the point of transition, then there are clearly, there's quite an extensive list of companies and entities that had been built by this particular regime that now obviously were going to form part of this democratic state. In the apartheid regime, you can imagine that not all of those entities actually would have passed a preliminary or even the most baseline case study for viability. In other words, some of them were simply kept alive, were simply kept going on the basis that the state had to subsidize them because they were necessary. It wasn't a matter of, well, if it's not working, we're simply going to shut it down and something new is going to emerge, because there were no new things emerging. So there was a very strong support mechanism for some of these entities in the pre-apartheid regime. But what the transition was supposed to usher in was a simple question of how do you make these entities viable on a standalone basis? And the ANC has really struggled with that particular question. So what you'll see is that in the first 5 years in particular, I was actually going through National Treasury's archives the other day, and you can see that in the first 5 years, they were quite open to the idea of saying, well, perhaps now that we've opened ourselves up to be part of the global market, some of the reasons that we had used before in order to insulate these particular entities from scrutiny and from competitive forces are no longer as strong. So you saw an ushering in of some privatization models, which simply wanted to be able to tap into the now newly available international capital out there. So SAA, for example, 20% of its stake was sold to SwissAir, and that was obviously in response to the general trends in the aviation industry since the 1990s, where big players would partner with smaller players across different regions in order to be able to expand one's network. So SAA gets privatized. We see the same thing happening at Telkom. We now know ISCO is gone. It's now part of ArcelorMittal. So there's a lot of case studies of how the government then said, well, we are not fixated necessarily on the idea of absolute ownership of every single thing else. So we're open to the idea of gradually letting in private capital. But ironically, that seems to have been just a short window or a small phase where there was evidence of that being the clear intention. And then thereafter, the government retreated back to the communist approach of saying absolutely everything must be under control. And I think obviously we now know that in the case of Eskom, for example, in the case of Transnet, they simply said, look, we do think that it is the best if the state remains fully in charge of these particular entities. And again, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. The simple question was, when you say that we must be fully in charge of this, are you able to ensure that they are managed and governed in a manner that enables them to deliver on their identified mandate? Because as soon as you fail that, as soon as they're unable to deliver on their mandate, there's basically the path to catastrophe, in the sense that not only do you have to deal with the suboptimal performance of the entity itself, but also the fact that it may then need assistance in the form of bailouts, for example, means that it starts crowding out other necessary initiatives that government wants to run. So if there's only 10 rand available and suddenly 4 rand has to go and bail out a state-owned enterprise, well, you only have 6 rand left to do for everything else, when in a perfect world, that 10 rand would be dedicated to everything else because the state-owned entities will be viable on their own, whatever the mandate has been decided by the government of the day.
But here's the thing, Akaya. It has become apparently clear that the state-owned entities are crowding out investments. To your assertion, the kind of cap-in-hand approach by the SOEs to Treasury and other sources does suggest that the current model of operational business ownership, you know, is not working. And not working and also not very sustainable in the near future. We do need this country to require a lot of investments, and unfortunately those investments and road, we've seen how terrible roads are. We are water scarce country. We need to be investing more and more on a water reservoir. We are not able to do that, and of course electricity has become such an issue. Surely it has, from a policy point of view, it should have dawned, I'm sure it has dawned to power that SB, that the current business model of SOEs are not sustainable, and something drastic has to happen. And for that to happen, we have to bring in as many private hands, if you like, so that they take off the burden, particularly those that are subminimal in terms of performance. And what has been the progress from that end? Because obviously, these things, they do take time to come to fruition.
That particular pendulum, we are essentially saying that we want to swing from full and absolute state ownership, like we currently have in the case of Eskom, for example, and move on to a more private sector aligned ownership model. Now, that particular pendulum does come with particular trade-offs, and I am of the view that before we swing extremely in the other direction, in other words, hand everything to private hands, we should interrogate the question of whether the missing component of this particular conversation isn't the professionalization and corporatization of these institutions before the privatization thereof. And the distinction there is quite clear, in that if you go to the mandates or the defined mandates of the most important state-owned enterprises, of the 700, not all of them are important, even though politicians would like to believe otherwise. So if you go through the most critical of them and you try to interrogate their mandate, it becomes very clear that a lot of them, if not all of them, have what we essentially refer to as a dual mandate. And the dual mandate is firstly the question of viability as an institution. Well, are you able to sort of survive as a business? And then the second one is what you refer to as a social mandate. And what that social mandate says is that, look, if anybody had to ask you what you do for a business as Eskom, if anybody had to ask what you do as a business as Rand Water or Joburg Water, you would tell us this is what you do, and then you tell us this is the cost of delivery, and then you tell us what the end price should be. So in a vanilla model, Eskom would tell you exactly how much it costs to generate electricity and to give it to me. Rand Water will tell you the same thing about water. And then the government had to take a step back and say, well, based on that vanilla model, we look at a population of 60 million citizens, and of that population of 60 million citizens, let us say just for argument's sake, about 30 million, are either completely unemployed or are they dependent on social grants for a living. So if you then consider the plight and the fate of those individuals and ask yourself the question of, would they be able to afford this end product that Eskom is providing and Rand Water is providing without any form of state assistance? And the answer is simple, no. So what we then have as a country is a rule of guidelines and policies that basically create what we may refer to as a social protection floor. And when I call it the social protection floor, it is a rule that says that, well, every citizen, for example, regardless of their means, must have 1 kiloliter of water per month in order for them to be able to drink. Every citizen, regardless of means, should be able to at least power on the lights for a few hours a day, for example. So those are just the simple examples of what the social protection floor design would be. And then what would then happen is to say, okay, cool, now that we know what the baseline entitlement is, let us then make sure in the management of public resources that we only roll out those free services to only those that absolutely need it. So suddenly Nimrod gets excluded from that entitlement on the basis that, look, we think he can on his own manage to be able to buy himself the first kiloliter of water or the first kilowatt hour of electricity. So therefore, he doesn't qualify for this social assistance package. Now, when you have a government that is committed to that, you can imagine how difficult it is for somebody to say, well, let us have this as a thoroughly private entity, because if I'm the CEO of a private entity, my primary responsibility is not to society, it's to shareholders. So I would simply say, well, actually, we'd make a bit more money. Our profits margin would be a bit better if we didn't have to give away this free electricity or this free water to the citizens that have been defined by the government. So therefore, we'd start cutting those people off, which means that we'd simply abandon the social mandate and we'd pursue the profit mandate as all shareholders would legitimately demand. Now, the obvious consequences of that is that suddenly the government would then have to figure out, well, how do you then ensure that the citizens that are entitled to some social protection floor or some social mechanism are still then being given access to these particular resources? And you either then would have to have the state being the intermediary buying from private enterprise in order to distribute you, and it becomes quite complicated. So that is the biggest consequence associated this idea of shifting from outright state ownership to outright privatization. One example that is a bit different is how the Public Investment Commission, the PIC, has actually undergone a corporatization journey over the past 8 years or so. So again, it's a state entity. And so you used to have a group of trustees whose responsibility it was to figure out how to manage the pensions of government employees. And of course, for a very long time, you can imagine how fluid the rules were and how complicated and inconsistent that particular model was. And when they then decided that they actually wanted to set up a more professional institution that was going to adopt the best private sector practices in relation to the management of assets and the management of pension assets, the modern day PIC was born. And what you'll now see is that obviously not only is the PIC the biggest pension manager of its size and scale in Africa, it is probably one of the more credible public institutions, with the exception of the shenanigans of the Mpati Commission that you remember so well. But it is one example that indicates to you that, well, even under a state ownership model, you can still be able to do things right. And South Africa quite simply hasn't done enough to replicate that model across all the key institutions. So we still have far too much politics going on in the management and the governance of key entities. And of course, once you compromise that, it kind of really doesn't matter what your mandate is. Somebody's going to eventually mess it up if they're incompetent for the job.
Absolutely. You know, there are quite a few points that you've raised, I mean, about the credibility of or the ability to replicate a success story such as the PIC, the telecom of this world. Let's take a break. But when you come back, I want us to address these very issues of social mandate and dual mandate in most of entities, the extent to which these are being addressed by the proposed National Enterprise Bill. Let's go to the break and we'll be back in a second.
Beyond Governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
Did you know that where markets are concerned, it's not easy to detect the difference between objective and subjective reality, or between reality and fantasy? The business's view of the consumer has serious bottom line implications. At Plus 94 Research, we help businesses cut through the uncertainty by gathering and processing real consumer intelligence through advanced scientific research methodologies. Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. My name is Nimrod. I am joined by Kaya Sithole, who's an accountant, an academic activist, and as well as an independent analyst. We're getting a very good sense of the complex nature of the state-owned entity landscape. Before we took that break, Kaya was giving us his thoughts around the transition from purely state-owned entities to a model that looks at a private and public sector reconfiguration to a point where some of the services can be roll out to majority of South Africans who, for obvious reasons, are not able to access. I mean, one obviously is water, the other one is electricity. These entities obviously come in to try and address some historical context, which is quite important. But what he raised again before we took that break was the extent to which the PIC, which evolved from Public Investment Commission to the current PIC, which is the biggest and credible asset institution in Africa and probably one of the best in the world, has been at the back of strategic focus and putting all the necessary resources which are associated with the private sector model. One, you obviously invest in competent skills and capabilities of men and women, and you have a very strong board and you have a very clear mandate, and you say to the entity, I want you to give these are your targets, and which the targets, when they're met, we are able to reinvest those kinds of resources back to society. So we clearly have a few success stories which we have not been able to replicate, of which if we were to replicate these, we are likely to see less and less likes of Denel, the likes of SAA, the likes of South African Express, Express, SABC, not coming to Treasury with cap in hand. In fact, they will be able to have some reserves on the basis of how they've been managed. And in some quarters, the National Enterprise Bill seems to be a panacea. But we all know that in this country, we have a very good ability to make pronouncement on policies. The implementation is a completely different issue. So I want to ask Kaya here on his interpretation of the National Enterprise Bill, for it is meant to insulate and or isolate or to create a buffer between the shareholders, which in the land function minister, and the entity, because so far the kind of issues that we've seen are as a result of interference from the shareholder and not allowing the entity to be managed accordingly. This kind of interference has really cost as an arm and a leg. Your take on that?
The National State Enterprises Bill seems to be the ultimate result of the president's own personal feelings, or rather his own personal preferences, and also what it is that the Ministry of Public Enterprises thought was necessary in order to just do something differently. So when I say it's part of the president's own personal mission, is that he has, in multiple instances over the past 6 years, kept telling us about the Singapore model, Temasek Holdings, which is essentially a state entity that was created to oversee other state entities and to make sure that there's consistency in how the governance models are and also what the compact is with society is and those state entities are. So it's a model that has worked quite well. I mean, it's one of the most successful examples out there. So the president has a personal liking to that. What unfortunately the president then does at the same time is that he decides to put somebody who's a hardcore communist in charge of public enterprises. And the reason that matters is, as I mentioned earlier on, that those with the more communist ideological orientation are the ones that are more likely to be champions of absolute control of everything. They call it the commanding heights of the economy. So it's not the type of individuals who are instinctively open to the idea of alternative ownership models and more flexible and agile ownership model. And that, of course, was Mr. Pravin Gordhan. So you had this eternal tension for the past 6 years where the president says these things need to work differently, and yet he hands it over to a person who completely believes that there's absolutely no other tenable option except the one where he, as a shareholder representative, is intimately engaged in directing the affairs of that organization. As it turned out, tragically for South Africa, the minister quite simply either never had the range of skills necessary to oversee what was a complicated portfolio, or it simply just could not be done at all. So one other thing that we haven't traversed is how the Department of Public Enterprises in South Africa is an accumulation of political accidents rather than a strategic portfolio. So why we call it an accumulation of political accidents is that if you look at how SAA, an aviation company, ends up being grouped together with Transnet, a logistics company, and with Eskom, an energy company, and with Danel, an aeronautics company, it is very clear that in putting those things together, it was when the political headwinds of the day decided that if you want to be able to bypass a particular minister or a particular structure in order to control ultimately that entity, you are better off moving into this newly created portfolio where you can then decide who must run that portfolio. And that, of course, simply means Jacob Zuma, Manusi Kikaba, and, you know, that entire transition from the times of Barbara Hogan. So it's an accidental portfolio rather than a strategic one. So I don't know if it was even possible for any single minister to have a universal and a holistic management approach for that particular portfolio. And what also happened is that in that particular accidental transfer, these companies essentially forgot their mandates in their home ministries. When we say they forgot their mandates in their home ministries, if you look at what it takes to run Eskom, for example, from the question of the Electricity Regulation Act and what the implication of the regulators are and all of that, and the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy, which obviously has a material impact on what Eskom does, it became very clear that not everything that was necessary in order to create a viable and a sustainable Eskom moved along with it in order to be able to say, okay, everything that matters to Eskom is now overseen by this one pair of eyes who has a holistic view of what are the consequences of one pronouncement are on other regulations and other policies. So we then had this paralysis between the Minister of Public Enterprises and the Minister of Mineral Resources and Energy, where essentially we couldn't tell who was actually in control of ESCOM. So that was a big tragedy of what we've seen over the past 6 years. So in this new state enterprises bill, it seems that the intention is to say across all these different institutions, there are far too many inconsistent and ad hoc processes towards the management of them, which makes it very difficult for the state to sort of understand what its own holistic approach is to managing these entities. So under this bill, the idea is to firstly deal with the elephant in the room that I mentioned earlier on, in that not all 700 of them are important, even though politicians prefer to think otherwise. So what the bill does is that it narrows down the scope to what we may really refer to as the most strategic enterprises in South Africa. And these are the ones where clearly that social mandate remains so fundamentally important. Government has to remain engaged in the question of what these entities do. They cannot afford to set it out because of the obvious social fallout that we associated with ESCOM, for example, saying that never again will anyone be given a free allocation of electricity, for example. So what they've done is that they've now narrowed down to the list of really truly strategic entities. And under those entities, the idea is to say, let us govern them differently, let us govern them better. But tragically, even in the crafting of that bill, you could see that the minister's own instincts would not actually be let go, in the sense that one of the clauses then says, oh, ultimately, it's the president who's really the shareholder here. So then the question is, well, isn't that always been the case? Because the president then simply designated a minister to represent him there. So what's the difference now? And of course, the issue here is that if you really are going to retain the same model and just name it differently, we are not sure how insulated these institutions are or how safe these institutions are from the inevitable arrival of another rogue politician who may have very different intentions and different motives from this. So if this state enterprises bill was to stand scrutiny, it needed to be able to exhibit exactly how that buffer between interference and operational autonomy is to be entrenched, rather than saying that, well, actually, we kind of have a president that we like, maybe, so therefore let us centralize a bit of the power in his hands, which I thought was a major flaw of that bill. But again, it's still in discussion stage, it's still under development. Maybe there'll be a refined version of it that makes sense to everyone who thinks that these entities need to be run and managed much better than what we've seen over the past 30 years.
No, thanks for that insight. I mean, a number of critical points that we've raised. I mean, it is important that we emulate other successful models. It is just that how we implement these. I mean, you're quite correct. The mere fact that we wanted to emulate Singapore, we have one entity that oversees other entities. Obviously, the challenge lies in how you strategically allocate non-partisan individuals to oversee that particular to that particular entities, which in the South African context seems to be a problem, and because the other issue that you eloquently alluded to is this dichotomy. We have a Minister of Energy and also Minister of Public Enterprise, and entities such as ESCOM have to rely on energy policies. And if the Minister of Energy is not in sync with the Minister of Public Enterprise, we have a colossal. I suppose this bill have recognized that, and to put to harmonize a policy regimen so that there is no competition between the ministers, because we have now seen it has come to public play how the Minister of Public and the Minister of Energy as well as Pravin Gordhan have public clashes on the fundamental policy position. And we can only hope that the new bill, based on your assessment, in that we will not just have the minister, the president, who deploy proxies, of which some of those proxies will replicate or go back to neanderthals that you've seen in the past. But what will be key, as a matter of mischief, it is supposedly the appointment of executive and appointment of the board. So these are two important variables which I'm not sure how the bill would address, because if the appointment of the CEO of an entity is designated to professionals, because the minister in any the minister have limited competencies around the template that he or she may use to ensure that the entities are being governed professionally. How do you think the bill will address the independence, if you like, of the board around this is what your mandate is, and these are the targets. You've got pretty much a blank check, provided you give us the returns on investment. How plausible is that trajectory?
So I think the big idea behind this is, even though the ANC was never going to put it on paper, is that what they're really trying to think of is a more professional deployment committee. And of course, a deployment committee that they previously used is got its own particular problems. The Chief Justice of South Africa actually says it's unconstitutional. But what the big idea was to do here is to have that professional structure that is the one that then says, look, we know that over time and over years, these institutions are going to require this type of expertise, oversight and governance expertise. But rather than leaving it to the whims of every single minister to check into their own black book about people who they think may or may not be good enough to be able to run these entities, let us perhaps have a national professional database of competent individuals with the type of multidisciplinary skills that are necessary in order to make a difference in these particular entities. So that whenever there's a vacancy that emerges, a minister is well aware that, oh, all I have to say is that the type of skill we've just lost was XYZ. The type of skill we're trying to onboard and replace is XYZ. So therefore, can whoever's responsible for managing that database of, you know, competent professionals, can they recommend a name that we will adopt as cabinet? You know, something that linear. And I think why that matters in particular is that it has now become quite clear that too much discretion has been given to politicians in order to make appointments that have long-term effects and long-term consequences for these particular institutions without us understanding what the real process behind the scenes and what the logic and the rationale is for selecting particular people to oversee particular entities. The National Student Fair and Child Aid Scheme is obviously the latest example of individuals who are probably very good in doing particular things, but were thoroughly hopeless in trying to oversee an institution of those complexities. And what you've ended up with is an institution in crisis and a board that had to be dissolved. And the question, and I suppose the litmus test for me, for this new state enterprises bill, is if you said, let us apply it in its current substantive form and try to see whether we would have emerged with the same names if we are appointing a board for the National Student Financial Aid Scheme, the answer has to be no if the bill is to stand up for scrutiny, because the bill is the one that should be able to say to us, okay, given the nature of this entity, given the nature of the issues, these are actually the names that emerge from the database that stand the best chance of turning the institution around. So therefore, these are the ones that should be recommended. So that's clearly where we need to be able to get to. Now, obviously, the problem with public policy making, Nimrod, is that it comes with trade-offs. And I think in this particular instance, the biggest trade-off is going to be the power that the ministers have to cede over this particular process, the power that they'd have to give up in order for them to simply say, we are trusting a more professional and a more credible and legitimate process to give us the right people to run the institutions that we oversee, rather than them feeling that, well, I must only appoint people that I'm comfortable will be able to help me deliver, because that seems to be the rationale that they use now. And the simple rationale is that, well, I'm responsible ultimately for this institution, so therefore I must find people that I already either personally resonate with or people that I think I'm close enough to be able to say, let us work together here. That seems to be the rationale that the ministers apply in making these particular choices. But we now know that it hasn't worked out. So therefore, it will be important for us to capitalize on this idea of how to leverage this bill in order to create a more professional, public service model that not only talks about what the public service and administration and the public service commission is doing in professionalizing the civil society, the civil sector at large, but also what we do in the governance of public institutions, because that's been the missing component until now.
Absolutely. Very interesting observation indeed. We're going to take a quick turn and we'll be back in a second.
Beyond Governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
Did you know that where markets are concerned, it's not easy to detect the difference between objective and subjective reality, or between reality and fantasy? The business's view of the consumer has serious bottom line implications. At Plus 94 Research, we help businesses cut through the uncertainty by gathering and processing real consumer intelligence through advanced scientific research methodologies. Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
Welcome back to Beyond Governance. We're gravitating towards the end of a very interesting conversation that I'm having with Kaya Sitolo, who's an accountant, an academic activist, an independent analyst. The essence of our discussion is about the relevance and appropriateness of governance model in the public sector. We have noted, obviously, with displeasure about the kind of challenge that we are seeing in most of our state entities that are not governed accordingly. Before we took that break, Kaya made a very interesting point, which I just want to hone in slightly. One of them is that obviously the bill, the national state enterprise bill, seeks to professionalized the appointment of these entities. One of that is that we would have a professional deployment committee, which will obviously replace the controversial CADA deployment committee, if you like. And this would obviously allow the entities, this structure, this committee, a much bigger power, or to allow it much bigger power in terms of developing a template which the minister can use, around the appointment, the skill sets that are required. Should this obviously be successful, that will limit the minister's power, because if the minister has a database, it's easy to call on those particular names. And so that we're able to deploy credible men and women with the necessary skill sets and competencies, and be supported, most importantly, by the land function minister. But we've also seen that not all the executives enjoyed the support from the land function politician, and which is something that we need to be very careful about. We have seen some boards which we felt that the minister, the land function minister, has been interfering. Case in point is Eskom, and I'm sure many other entities wherein the land function minister is interfering to a point where boards were like, what are we doing here? So the point that I want to raise is that if the current dispensation has given too much discretion to the land function minister around appointment of the board and to some extent an appointment of the CEOs, this presupposes that this land function minister is competent himself. And we have not seen a high turnaround of ministers that are not doing their jobs. How will this bill address non-performance? Because it cannot be that the ministers have all capabilities and we've seen so many dreadful flaws and yet there's no accountability. We have not seen the ministers being fired. For an example, do we have access to the ministers' performance agreement? We have access to ministers' deliverables, and of which we can weigh. But just by looking at how some of the ministers perform, clearly there is no credibility in terms of what contract looks like and what are they expected to deliver. To what extent do you think the bill will address some of these issues, which are obviously controversial?
It absolutely doesn't, and it won't. And I think the reality, of course, is that this is a bill that has been crafted by a particular minister and a particular ministry. And the irony is that it is probably one of the most underperforming ministers that has been responsible for putting this together. So there's no way that such an accountability mechanism was going to be prominent in there. It's also important for us to acknowledge that even though the president has told us that he has an intention of signing performance agreement with all these ministers, that was a PR exercise. The performance agreements do exist. And from the moment they've been signed, absolutely nothing has been done to them. So it's not a system that unfortunately is used to accountability. It's not a system where those that underperform then run the risk of being redeployed also. In fact, the only time where ministers lived under the perpetual fear that they may be reshuffled, that insecurity was predated on what Jacob Zuma wanted to be able to do in order to maintain his element of control over the cabinet rather than him undertaking a study of who was competent where and then shifting them elsewhere. So ANC ministers quite simply do not live under the threat of being redeployed because they are not delivering. So that's not what what happens ordinarily. Even in this bill, it would be unlikely to do so because, remember, if this bill emerges with that type of instruction that then says to the president, however, if Minister X cannot prevent load shedding for 10 consecutive days, then therefore you must do the following. Because that would obviously now be usurping the president's powers to appoint cabinet. It would be an instruction to the ultimate executive authority himself, and not a single cabinet member sitting across the room at a point in time when that bill is deliberated would ever sign up for that, because it would simply just feel like it's a premiership by default, where whoever is in charge of overseeing that bill is the one that then basically gets to advise the president that, oh, this one is not achieving that, so please shift them also. This is simply not going to happen within the type of decision-making and law-making process that South Africa currently has.
Absolutely. My goodness, we seem to have a lot of work to be done. But I suppose when this bill is being subjected to public scrutiny, individuals such as yourself and other credible institutions in the public sector will be able to weigh in and really make a significant input so that we are able to at least, subject the current bill to litmus test so that it's able to really shave much power that has been accorded to the minister, because we all know that some of the ministers are pursuing nefarious, motives which aren't necessarily, to the benefit of society, but to the benefit of a narrowly defined political agenda. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to leave it here, Kai. It has been absolutely beautiful. Thank you for your credible insight on how we understand the governance model and the complexities which government has to really navigate, which aren't necessarily easy. So your perspective has really shed a huge light to a lot of listeners who said, my goodness, I didn't know this is what it takes. And these are some of the competing priorities, and these are some of the trade-offs which the land funding minister, the boards, and SOEs themselves have to navigate. Thank you very much for your time.
And thank you, and have a wonderful day.
Absolutely. There was Kaya Sithole, who is an accountant, an academic activist, an independent analyst, giving us a very robust insights on how incredibly complex the state-owned entities is. We now obviously have a bill that is before us, and he pointed out some of the serious limitation of the current bill in relation to the appointment, the role and function of the minister, and the mandates of entities, the dual mandates of these entities, which are very confusing in so many instances, as well as the powers that sits with the board. Let's hope this particular bill will give us more insights on how to navigate these particular issues. It has been absolutely beautiful, and enjoy your day further. Shalom.
When a nation comes together on buildrsa.co.za, it can only lead to a greater South Africa. All that's missing is you. Go to buildrsa.co.za to join the conversation, get involved in problem solving, and contribute to taking our nation to the next level. By South Africans, for South Africans. So, register for free now at buildrsa.co.za. The Great Africa. Together, we will build it.